And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. It's, of course, Dominion Day. I'm sorry, it's Canada Day. We're going to get our name straight. And with me is Phil Conlon. How you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to talk about the dynamic news coming from Syria and Egypt. There's a lot of big matters we want to learn about, and we're going to talk to Mahdi Nazimroya. You can find his writing, of course, in at globalresearch.org and other spots. And Nazim is the author of The Globalization of NATO, a very important book. And by the way, Mahdi's been doing some traveling. I think he's just back from Beirut. I'm not absolutely certain about that, but, you know, we're in the Internet time, so you can just put his name up and you see Mahdi in one place of the world or another. He was, by the way, a very brave correspondent who went into Libya when at a very dangerous time and came back with important reports. The second guest, by the way, at the halfway point is going to be Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States. He is the founder of the International, pardon me, I think I got that right, the better look at my note to make sure, the International Action Center, pardon me, IA Center, letters I, letter A, and then center.org, and that will be Ramsey Clark. He'll be at the at about 5:30, but we're joined now by the author, Mahdi Nazimroya. Are there, Mahdi?
Hi, how are you?
Good, and very glad to be talking to you today, because nobody has followed this matter of the recent events in Syria, Egypt, of course, in your experience with Libya. As nobody's followed it any more closely than you. I have to start with Syria, because the last time we spoke to you, you were noting that the Syrian government had probably surprised the great imperial powers by surviving the onslaught by mercenaries sponsored by Gulf monarchies and backed by the U.S. and France. What would you say the state of that struggle is at the moment?
Well, I want to emphasize from the very beginning that the only reason it surprised them is because of their imperial arrogance. that's why they're surprised. The state of affairs in Syria is there's a retreat for this so-called revolution, really an insurgency. The so-called rebels are in retreat, and they're being fought right now around the Damascus countryside, a few places in the governorate of Homs, and primarily around Aleppo in the northwest of Syria near the Turkish border. They are facing low morale, demanding more weapons, and trying to get more men coming in. The border with Lebanon has fired up now more than ever. There's the fighting in Syria has spilled over into Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Hezbollah has intervened. Members from the anti-government forces, the so-called rebels in Syria, have gone into Lebanon. Mm-hmm. They fired rockets into Lebanon. They've helped Sheikh Ahmed al-Astir in the city of Sidon, or in Arabic, Sida. They've helped him fight the Lebanese military. Mm-hmm. So the conflict is now, Lebanon has been opened up as a front in this conflict. Mm-hmm. I was looking for another word, but you know, I was going to say war.
Yeah,
but
it's hard to find any other words for it. Is there a desire on the part of these rebels to either provide a pretext or an excuse for greater intervention from the Western powers?
Yes, from the very beginning, them and their supporters have been looking for every single possible excuse for more foreign intervention. Let me emphasize to listeners, this war is a war of foreign intervention. It's just there's different types of foreign intervention. Some forms are not direct, but if we're talking about foreign weapons, foreign funding, foreign fighters, foreign logistics, foreign diplomatic backing and cover, if we're talking about intelligence operatives, if We're talking about media assistance, i.e. media warfare. Yes, there is. This is a war for an intervention against the Syrians. But in conventional terms, it's not. We don't have the American government or NATO and its allies officially declaring war against the Syrians. Instead, they're bleeding the country by sending these armed groups, many of which are paid. Now it's documented public that they're being paid large amounts to go fight. Some of these people are destitute people coming from different places, and they're making more in a few days than they would make in a span of a year. Others are there because of ideological reasons, twisted ideological reasons. Some have been brainwashed. In fact, a group of Tunisian mothers from Tunisia and North Africa were in Syria very recently, and their children were caught, young men, trying to enter the border in Syria to fight what they thought was a jihad, essentially a holy war. Their mother said they were brainwashed by clerics from the Gulf, basically, I believe. Mm-hmm. Clerics, of course. And the mothers went there and they saw things in Syria. That these Tunisian young men repented, and the Syrians told them, the mothers, since they didn't kill anybody and we caught them at the border, we're going to send them back. This is why the Tunisian government requested for Syria to reinstate diplomatic channels or relationships with Tunis. That's the real reason why.
That's a very big development. I mean, that's a serious retreat, right? Because they were trying to get all the momentum going the other way.
Yeah, the momentum's going against them. I mean, the Syrians have real friends and allies. I mean, we can see where every country in the world stands because of their position on Syria.
Mm-hmm. By the way, the Arab masses, if I can use that expression, they must be on the side of Syria in their hearts. I mean, after all, they do understand and remember colonialism. They when they hear the president of France make a declaration, or the president of the United States or Britain, as Arabs, they must say, you don't have any business telling any Arab state what to do.
Well, many of them are. And a lot of them, unfortunately, because of the brainwashing of not only local media or pan-Arab media, like the Saudi-owned Al Arabiya or Future TV, which is owned by the Hariri family in Lebanon, they've been brainwashed in distant places like Morocco. Of course, they don't want foreign intervention. They don't want to see non-Arab countries get involved in the affairs of an Arab state. And of course, they don't like the local despots. Of course, they don't like their local rulers. I think a lot of them notice the irony that's involved here. Countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, where there's really no democracy, or very little in the case of Kuwait. These countries are trying to shove democracy down the throat of Syria. Yes. It's not real democracy.
By the way, it's also an opportunity, isn't it, too? And by the way, this is Mahdi Nazim Roya. To witness some irony here in the Western media complimenting the emir of Qatar for this smooth transition, this handing to his son absolute power in a country, and polite applause here, but that's how it's supposed to be done. But when they talk about Syria, it's a dictatorship and a dynasty. They were just applauding the dynasty in Qatar.
That's hypocrisy. They say nothing when one dictator, what happened in Doha is one dictator passed on the mantle of absolute power to another dictator. I don't see what's applaudable about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're making a lot to do about nothing by complimenting what's happened there.
By the way, can I ask you for some micro thoughts about this? I know that it's very hard for us to understand it from here, but you, of course, know and have traveled there. But there is reports of problems. Well, one is that, of course, that they didn't succeed where they thought it was going to be easy with Syria. But then there and that's causing some arguments. I understand, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but that there's some problem between Saudi Arabia and Qatar as to who's going to be the boss. And that this may have something to do with the stepping down of the emir.
That's very good. Very keen that you picked up on that. I think listening to, well, on the basis of the speech of the new emir, of Qatar, It seems that Qatar's foreign policy will be streamlined with Saudi foreign policy now. And Qatar will subordinate itself to an extent to Riyadh. From what he's saying, he's very pro-Saudi, and he's very pro-American, the new emir.
There is the Iranians, a fifth fleet to reinforce that love.
The Iranians are talking about the new emir, hopefully, like Syria's, Qatar's foreign policy on Syria is going to change, and they've been very hopeful about this and wishful. I don't see it like that at all. I know that the emir of Qatar was supposed to pass on power in August 2013 to his son, so it happened earlier. And a lot are saying that he could be one of the first tragedies of this project in Syria going wrong. Others are pointing to Erdogan in Turkey, and others to Morsi, all the people that are against Syria. Something's
isn't
going
it
wrong
interesting?
For them.
Yeah, 3 months ago, all of those who are standing like roosters crowing that they're going to knock over Assad, Erdogan and Morsi and the emir flying in and out of Gaza and such places, and he's. But now they are all seem to be shaking.
Well, the emir's gone. His retirement. Going back, I want to jump back to what you said about the rivalry between the Al Thani family in Qatar and the House of Saud in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. He emphasized that we need new blood, a young generation to take over. And this could actually be in between the line gesture to Saudi Arabia, meaning to the king of Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah. It could be a gesture saying step down, because, you know, there's been many rumors and reports in the last few years, and including this year, of attempts of a coup d'etat, a palace coup to replace King Abdullah with another member of the royal family because he's too old. In fact, some of his crown princes died. You know, he's outlived them. Yeah. So this could be a message to him.
They inherited the earth.
Yes. So this could be in between the line message telling him to step down as well. It's time to pass on the mantle of rulership in Saudi Arabia. And I think if there's a new ruler in Saudi Arabia, they'd probably be much more aggressive with Syria than the current regime is.
Yeah. Now, by the way, and it is Saudi Arabia, isn't it, who is driving the sectarianness that it is so lethal and ugly throughout the whole region? They are insisting on their leadership against, and that they're the only Muslims, right? That if someone else is a Muslim, unless he's a member of their clannish view of Islam, they're not Muslims.
Well, I think they're hiding behind Islam. I wouldn't consider them really religious, to be honest with you, because knowing the rulers of Saudi Arabia and the members of the royal family who run this kingdom, some people call it a kingdom of horrors, when they travel overseas, they're known for using cocaine, getting prostitutes, drinking alcohol, doing all types of things that... someone you would consider
there have been some tremendous scandals. I mean, there was
in Britain,
there was a body of a servant, is my memory, and it was rather unseemly story. But anyhow, I interrupted. Go ahead, please.
No, right, but this is a regular thing. Foreign workers in these Gulf countries, these petro monarchies, regularly get abused and killed. I mean, and nothing is done. A lot of human rights organizations are very silent about it, and it shows you the hypocrisy of the state of affairs in the world, where American or international NGOs that are supposedly there for human rights say very little about what the Saudis or the Qataris do, or any American allies. But, I mean, these are trademarks of these people. These despots, these regimes, a lack of human rights, a lack of respect for human dignity and rights,
and
abuse of foreign workers.
Yeah. I should mention, I read Pepe Escobar had a piece recently about this emir business. He pointed out the population is basically 1.9 million or 2 million people, that only 200,000 are citizens. Everybody else is an employee. And a worker can't leave that country without an exit permit.
Many times.
I mean, that's serfdom.
Many times when they enter the country, their passports are taken away from them. And many times they don't even really get the pay that they
I guess Obama it. Hasn't heard about this because, you know, he believes in freedom.
No, Obama enforces serfdom. He's there as a corporate muscle man. I mean, the U.S. government there is defending the rights of corporations, not human rights. Mm-hmm. I mean, human rights is used as a pretext to rein in governments that are against multinationals, you know, socialist governments or any government that is counter to the capitalist world order. But a lot of these workers in the Gulf are locked up and left to sleep in the factories. In fact, there's been times where the factories have gone on fire or a facility, and these people have died because they were locked in and they couldn't get out. I mean, that's the living conditions they live in. And the Indian embassies in these countries have done, I wouldn't say great jobs, but they've done mediocre jobs of documenting the abuse of their nationals. And same thing with other countries of South Asia or the Indian subcontinent, such as Bangladesh.
Yeah, because their populations know the truth, because their children come home from these jobs or write to them, and they know the reality of the place better probably than certainly than Canadians. They have a better grasp of what's going on there.
There is a different type of treatment, too. I mean, these societies are based on hierarchies, very racist, very sexist. Mm. Everything you have. They're modern, if I can use biblical terms, they're modern Sodom and Gomorrah, actually. And they abuse Filipino workers, Indian workers, Pakistani workers, what have you, who come there. They import in Russian prostitutes, Ukrainian prostitutes. I mean, this is the state of affairs there. And, I mean, these people are talking about Islam and morality and democracy in Syria. I'll tell you something, human rights in Syria, although it is by far was not a democratic country or an ideal country by my standards, it's a much better place than Saudi Arabia.
It shines or the United States.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And if you get sick there, you know, you can survive. I mean, the healthcare, the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, I'll give you an example. In Syria, if you get sick, you can easily afford to buy your medicine because the pharmaceutical industries are nationally owned. They're not private. But in a place like Lebanon or Indonesia, let's say, if you get sick, it could cost you 2 months' salary for your medication. That's the difference between these places.
Sure.
I mean, education is free there. I'll tell you one thing I've noticed about Syrians in comparison to their neighbors, the Lebanese, although they're the same stock of people, they are the same stock of people, just they have a different political history because of colonialism. The Syrians are not sectarian, most of them. Some are, but the majority, like most Canadians, are not sectarian. It doesn't matter if you're a Shiite Muslim, an Alawite, a Sunni Muslim, a Catholic Christian, an Orthodox Christian, or a Druze, or a Jew. It doesn't matter. You're Syrian, they don't look at you because of any of those things. They're very civilized and gentle people. They won't, if you're a foreigner in their country, majority of them will not try to rip you off or give you overpriced rates. I mean, they're not there to embezzle. They don't want to rip anybody off. It's a very gentle, well, it was. I mean, now is a different story. I mean,
well, they're fighting to restore it, right, to save it.
When
they're finished with the mercenaries, they'll probably go back to being regular people. This is Mahdi Nazimroya. He's the author of Globalization of NATO. And I better make sure I ask you about last question on Syria, and maybe we could tie it in with Egypt too, but because I want to ask about Egypt. But Obama has used this language. The red line, as he says, has been crossed. The president has to step down because he's an imperial leader and he gets to say these things, I guess. And weapons will now be provided to these mercenaries who have been cutting the heads off Catholics, etc. But on the other side, the Chinese and the Russians, who are also members of the Security Council, have indicated maybe they think it's a red line, too. Are both sides prepared to go for to win this? What do you think?
I think that lines have been drawn in the sand. Obama's red line was bluff. It's a pink line. It keeps on falling back. In fact, their red line on Iran has been the same thing on nuclear development. But
maybe he only has a red pencil. Maybe they should teach him how to use other crayons.
Yeah, maybe they should. But in regards to that issue, it's been a bluff. It's been always used as a pretext, as everybody should know when weapons of mass destruction are brought in. It's always a pretext, and against America's enemies, of course. It's a pretext. The organization, the international organization that's responsible for monitoring chemical weapons, said there's no proof. Okay, they say it does not meet the proof that the Americans and their allies have provided does not meet international standards, and we can't accept it. Even the United Nations investigator has said no. It's the other side that used chemical weapons, and we know that for a while the other side was threatening to.
Mm-hmm.
They showed a YouTube video where they killed an animal. You know, they took over a chemical factory that was partially Saudi-owned in the north, I believe.
Yeah, I suppose they were tempted almost to make sure that chemicals were there so as to provide a pretext for the entry of the Western powers.
I think it was a pretext, of course. Now, the entry is what we can start fiddling with. Was it to send more weapons? By the way, when Obama says we're sending weapons now, that's a lie. They were doing it from the very beginning.
Yeah,
all of them were. The Saudis were. I remember at the Arab League, after the Arab League meeting, the Saudis in the Gulf country said, now we're going to send weapons. They lied. They were doing that months before that. From the very beginning, they were sending weapons into the country. And we know now that Obama was aware the weapons were going into the country. And he just arrogantly, like an emperor, said, Assad must step down. What leader of... No leader of any other country can tell the leader of another country to step down. In fact, that's against the United Nations Charter, which is the supreme law on of the earth. I mean, those laws in the United Nations Charter were created for a reason. So we don't have more world wars.
To prevent war, yes. Now, Nazim, I must ask you, because these big demonstrations... Really tremendous demonstrations, if the reporting is any way accurate, against Morsi in Egypt. Now, Morsi was another one who said, oh, Assad must go. And Morsi, it would have been 2 weeks ago, said, I'm calling on the Western powers to establish a no-fly zone. I mean, to me, I date his problems. I know he has a lot of problems, but the Egyptian people must have been repelled when he said that. They seem to be fed up with him. What's moving these demonstrations? Who's leading them, and what do they want?
Well, it's an eclectic body, the demonstrations in Egypt. A lot of people in Egypt have turned against him because of many factors, including rising unemployment, the foreign policy situation, brute force, the foreign exchange rate, you name it. There's a whole bunch of reasons why
everyone thought there was going to be a new policy. When Mubarak went, they thought, well, now we're going to revisit Camp David because of the fact that Camp David just turned out to be a hoax on the Palestinians. And, of course, he immediately put that aside. And then they thought, well, we're going to tell the IMF that they can't dictate. And then he says, yes, they can. I mean, why do they need him?
Well, Let me emphasize something. What happened in Egypt is not a revolution. I mean, most of us wish a revolution occurred. It's not a revolution yet. It could be in the process of becoming a revolution, but it's not a revolution. Things have to change politically, economically, and sociologically for a revolution to occur. There has been mass psychological change in the mindsets of the Egyptian people. They have revolutionary mindsets. They're not afraid of the military. They're not afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood or any dictatorship, and they're going to stand up to them. So their mindsets are revolutionary. But in regards to the Egyptian state, the Arab Republic of Egypt, nothing has changed. Foreign policy has remained. The people in the intelligence are the same people that are closely working with the CIA and the Pentagon and with the Mossad in Israel, the same people. In fact, the cabinet ministers are still people from the old Mubarak regime. The foreign minister is the same foreign minister from when Mubarak was around. These are people from the old regime. Yes, you have a few Muslim Brotherhood figures. What's happened is it's a cosmetic change. Egypt's economy is now more controlled by foreign governments and corporations than it was under Mubarak. I mean, They have not gotten rid of their international agreements and their peace treaty with Israel. And it's not that I'm against peace. It's because it was a one-sided peace treaty that basically mm-hmm. makes Egypt Israel's servant. Mm-hmm. They haven't gotten rid of that at all. And the gas deals with Egypt, Israel, they haven't got rid of that. They haven't helped the Palestinians. In fact, a lot of Palestinians have disappeared in Egypt and reappeared in Israeli jails. Why? Because they're still helping the Israelis against the Palestinians, specifically in the Gaza Strip. They're still helping in the siege against Gaza. They're destroying the smuggling tunnels, and they're preventing goods from going into Gaza. Yes, they eased things a bit, but it was basically to make the Egyptian people and the broader Arab public a little happy, but they're still working with Israelis.
Then they changed it back, yeah.
And they've actually helped try to de-link Hamas away from its allies. Who are the allies? Syria, Hezbollah, other Palestinian groups, and Iran. So they've worked to nudge Hamas away, and they've basically tried to pacify Hamas mm-hmm. into leaving its resistance, roots of resistance against Israel. So they basically, Hamas has been pacified to an extent, and Egypt, along with Qatar, that's why the Emir of Qatar kept on going there, have helped pacify Hamas. Like, this is the type of stuff that the Muslim Brotherhood's been doing. And in regards to their policies, well, I mean, they claim to be Muslim, but their economic policies are actually un-Muslim. They're in breach of the Quran. They have an interest-based economy, and they deal with the International Monetary Fund, which is totally against specific tenets in the Quran.
Yeah, exactly. They can't keep both things going at the same time. Something is amiss. I started to call you Nazim. Mahdi, we're very grateful. You've written a great book. I hope people get it, The Globalization of NATO. And of course, your articles are appearing in globalresearch.ca.
May I say something quickly?
Please do. And by the way, we hope you're going to come to Toronto and give a speech. We're always glad to see you.
Well, I would love to come to Toronto. I've talked to somebody. I might be doing that. I just came back from the Middle East, though, so I need to recuperate a bit. But I want to point out that globalresearch.ca, mm-hmm. for some reason, Google is now blocking the site, direct access to it. You can't find it on an internet search. I guess maybe it's become so popular.
We'll have to rename it Google NATO.
Sure, but I wanted to point that out, and that's something we're trying to deal with, and hopefully we'll have resolved in this week.
Well, good. I'm really glad you point that out, because I know our listeners would like to join in clarifying that, because we need global research, and of course we need your writings, and we're very grateful that you were with us, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Mahdi Nazim Royal.